Okay, we are going to get started, restarted. Thank you everyone for your patience. Thank goodness for our catering this evening. Come in handy. Thank you everyone for your ongoing commitment to this meeting. We are going to resume our meeting at this time at agenda item 6.2. I am noting that we don't have sound to support the live streaming. So this is a now completely in-person meeting and we'll manage the expectations of just a couple of people who are hoping to ask a question online. We'll either facilitate those in writing if we can get in touch with them in time, or we'll organise for that at a future meeting. Is that birds? Wow, amazing. We're up to agenda item 6.2. What else could happen at this meeting? review of licensed premises local planning policy. Would councillors like a presentation on this item? No, thank you very much. I did have a councillor, I'm just saying this again, moving the motion, Councillor Leppert. And a councillor seconding the motion, Deputy Lord Mayor, thank you. Back to you, Councillor Leppert, thank you very much.
Thank you, Lord Mayor. I'm delighted to move this motion. This is the result of a motion that was passed in the December Council meeting requesting this report. And I think that the report suggests a series of relatively moderate changes to the Melbourne planning scheme that could theoretically be put in place before the 30th of June to make sure that when the 1st of July comes and the state government's cessation of the late night liquor freeze on applications comes into place, we know that our planning policy is robust and ready to take on any potential increase in planning permit applications for licensed premises, but also that we can continue to respond to the Liquor Commission, because we use our planning policy to do that anyway. So I want to thank our city strategy team and our city planning team for working together, and to Kate and Sophie for coming up with a suite of recommendations. In summary, these recommendations are going to make sure that there's consistency across the central city, that in Docklands, in those areas where you don't need a permit for a place of assembly now, you will, if the Minister agrees with this way forward, so that some of the definitions in the local policy for licensed venues around what it means to be a noise-sensitive area and what the decision guidelines are around awarding planning permits for venues that operate after 1 a.m. are clearer for all parties, not just the council, not just developers, but also residents and everyone who uses the planning system. And I emphasise that this is not an exercise in trying to greatly loosen or greatly tighten the rigour around late-night licensed venue permits. It's about making sure that the policy is as clear and as understandable as it can be, so that we can balance those two really important competing interests. One, the right to a good night's sleep for a residential population that has grown by an extraordinary amount over the life of this policy. And two, the need to continue to retain that special mix of uses, that genuine mix of entertainment and economic uses that we expect in a central city, and that those licensed venues can continue to operate with reasonable conditions being applied to them. So that's the purpose of this. I think this moderated motion, which is slightly different to the recommendation, endorses everything in the report but puts a little bit more rigour around report back and sets us up well for a conversation with the Minister. And that is the last thing I'll say, that the state government is the agent of change to the regulatory framework. It was a few days before the state election that it was announced that the freeze on late night liquor licences would cease at the end of June. That is going to potentially put a bit more exposure and a bit more pressure on our planning policies. And so we want the Minister and the department to work with us to make sure that both the liquor side and the planning side are fit for purpose come 1st of July. And I think this sets us up to do just that. So again, thank you for everyone involved, and I commend the motion.
Thank you, Councillor Leppett. Deputy Lord Mayor.
Thanks, Lord Mayor, and thank you, Councillor Leppett, for moving the motion this evening. As we approach this item, this agenda item, I think all councils agree that it's all about getting the balance right, recognising the needs of our residents and our community, while also maintaining a healthy and busy nighttime economy. We do know that the nighttime economy is going to be even more important for Melbourne going forward as people's work patterns, transport patterns have changed as a result of COVID. And so that hospitality events and nighttime economy is going to be a bigger share of the overall economy of Melbourne going forward. Having said that, the residents and our community are absolutely entitled to the peaceful enjoyment of their homes. I do want to assert in the clearest possible terms that there are risks associated with lifting liquor licences to 3 a.m. in the city. The difference between 1 a.m. and 3 a.m. may only be 2 hours on the clock, but it can be a lifetime of difference when you're having a night out on the town. It's also important to note that when the freeze was introduced just over a decade ago, there's about 28,000 people living in the central city and Docklands. Now that figure's close to 60,000 people. So there's been a huge change in the complexion of the central city over the last decade. And so we need to respond to that. We can't be, the state government cannot be blind to that in setting the regulatory terms. Now, the Victorian government did commit to lifting the 1 a.m. licence in the context of an election campaign, and they have been elected, so and they have signalled that they are intending to proceed with that commitment that they made. They did also make a commitment to reviewing the regulations prior to making a decision on this, and I would call on the state government to make good on the commitment to properly review the regulatory arrangements before they proceed with that change from 1 a.m. to 3 a.m. There's been a lot of discussion today in the media and elsewhere about the City of Melbourne's role in all of this, but at the end of the day, it's a state government decision that is being made here to change from 1 a.m. to 3 a.m. and it's Liquor Control Victoria, a state agency, who will be principally responsible for regulation in this area. And so for the city's role, city's part, we do have a role to play, but we'll be very much a partner of the state government in this. So in terms of this review that we're saying needs to occur, there's some really specific and important things that I think we need to look at. The first is just getting the language right. The change of the word tavern, which is quite a old-fashioned sort of a term, updating that to bar so that you've got consistency across different parts of liquor regulation and planning regulation. Secondly, and more substantially, I would put, we need to get clear and in writing that the decision guidelines that will guide Liquor Control Victoria for 3 a.m. licences should be also there in the planning scheme. And we need to get that clear definition of noise-sensitive areas as well. Again, it's all about getting the balance right. And so I'll just conclude by saying that from a City of Melbourne perspective, we are obviously going to be a strong voice for our community. We're going to be a balanced, strong voice for our community, but we're also going to work as a cooperative partner with the state government in this area. And so we look forward to that engagement with the Minister, with the Premier, and with the state government to get this right.
Thank you, Deputy Lord Mayor. Sound check. Can everybody hear us okay, particularly in the back rows there? Good. Thank you. Are there any other speakers to this motion? No? Then I'm going to put the motion to the vote. All those in favour, please raise your hand. That motion is carried. Thank you very much. Agenda item 6.3 is the neighbourhood model progressing the priorities. It's Major Initiative 37. Would councillors like a presentation on this item? No, thank you. I'm calling on a councillor to move the motion. Councillor Dr. Ball, thank you. And a councillor to second the motion. Councillor Hakim, thank you. Councillor Dr. Ball, thanks.
Thank you. No problem with that. Sorry. Thank you very much, Lord Mayor. I'm very glad to move this motion. The neighbourhood model we've heard about already this evening. Can you hear me? It's genuinely innovative and exciting and democratic. What this arose from is striving to devolve planning and contact with the community as the closest level of government to you, the people, to we, the people, by having not one plan for the entire municipality, but recognising the distinct areas of the municipality, the distinct neighbourhoods and suburbs and the CBD in all of their variety. And the original thought was to have these different plans for the different parts of the municipality in a document that would be static for a fixed period of time, as much of our planning does occur. It might be a 3-year, 5-year, 10-year plan. And then, I don't know, someone had the genius idea that with the technologies we have today, these plans can be continuous. And our engagement with the community, what they want and need for their locality, can be continuously in dialogue with government and in feedback, and we can collate these the feedback from the community to update and respond in real time to what each part of the municipality needs. So you couldn't get much more democratic than that. However, we're attempting to by reviewing what we've done so far. So you've had a flavour of what we've done so far, and I hope you've all been on Participate Melbourne to try it out for yourself and to sign up so that when something new comes on that website, you will get a notification. You can go and have a look and have your say. With this proposal tonight also includes a review and some research with an august research partner yet to be announced and confirmed to look at what's happening so far and how we can expand that. We are accumulating everything that comes to us through the Participate Melbourne website and each of the individual neighbourhood portals that relate to each suburb and the CBD. But we could go even further through every phone call we receive that comes into council from the community, to every comment on our social media, to every interaction we have with our public-facing members of staff, whether they're on the streets, in our dog parks, in our libraries, and so forth, feeding that all into how we plan and understand our community and do what it wants and needs. So that's to sum up the gist of what this is about. I am very excited about it, and I hope you will all engage with it, because there's no lever like this. I think what we're doing is really quite innovative and new, and I hope it catches on. We're very privileged to have the capacity to do this and to recognise, we should all recognise that this is quite a privilege to have the resources to put into this, but I commend it to all of my colleagues on the committee tonight.
Thank you, Councillor Dr. Ball. Councillor Hakim, to you as seconder. Thank you.
Thank you, Lord Mayor. Thanks, Councillor Dr. Ball, for moving the motion. And thanks to Rushta and the team and all our neighbourhood partners for all the work you do. We work really hard at the City of Melbourne to ensure that we are engaging with our communities, and neighbourhoods matter, and this is what this is all about. And it's been terrific to see this program and this major initiative flourish and grow. This is about the next step around how it will move and grow. I do want to also say a big thank you to all our locals who have taken all the time to engage and take part in the different events and grants that deliver as part of this program. What we've seen is bringing things like micro grants for community to deliver programs in their local community because they know best, work really well, stepping aside from some of the spaces where making it easier for local communities and local people to be able to actually go directly and work directly with local government, with us, the City of Melbourne, to deliver programs has meant better interaction, faster interaction, and meant we can deliver more. And they're the sort of things that the neighbourhood program looks at. So, councillors, I commend this program to you and look forward to what it will bring back and continue to grow with.
Good. Thank you, Councillor Hakim. Are there any other speakers to this motion? Councillor Griffiths.
Thank you, Lord Mayor. Anyone who is a regular attendee at FMCs will know that I don't like to let an opportunity to talk about the neighbourhood model pass without contributing myself. And I'd like to thank again Councillor Dr. Ball and Councillor Hakim for their work on stewardship of this important program, and of course the officers who do all of the work behind the scenes. This motion is important for a few reasons, but the two components I'd really like to call out are the fact that we are recommitting to telling the community that we're doing this important work. There's that old sort of adage in politics that if you want a message to get across, you have to say it once, you have to say it again, you have to keep saying it until you're sick of saying it, and it's at that stage that people might, out in the wild, actually hear about it. And I think that often within council, once we've sort of launched something, once we've spoken about it internally once, we move on to the next part of the process, and we may not have actually communicated out more broadly the important work that is being done through something like the neighbourhood model. I was reminded of that last week, walking home from Docklands through West Melbourne that we're talking about tonight, and talking to some of the locals about the kinds of things that are on the portal that we saw tonight in that excellent presentation at the start. And it's excellent to be able to share with them that there is this resource for them. It was excellent to see the information about the Hawke Street Linear Park go up on Friday, and to be able to direct people in that way to find that information. But it would be even better if everyone in the community was already knowing that that's where they go and was taking that work on for themselves in discovering what was going on in their local community. So fantastic to see that we're really building that community awareness and the targeted communications. And we'll talk more in a few moments about the importance of research and data and actually measuring what we're doing in a meaningful way. I agree we're really lucky at the City of Melbourne to have the resources to be able to do that and to be able to work with really good partners to analyse new programs as they roll out. And fantastic that this will be one of those marquee bits of work that incorporate that approach. So for those reasons, I'm very happy to support the motion.
Thank you, Councillor Griffiths. Are there any other speakers to the motion? Well, I'm just going to say I love our neighbourhood plans, I love our neighbourhood portals, and I love our neighbourhood priorities. So keep going, team. And thank you to everyone in the community that is engaging with us through this new structure. Long may it continue to reap benefits for us all. So thank you very much. And good luck with the work ahead. If there are no other speakers, then I'm putting the motion to the vote. All those in favour, please raise your hands. Unanimous, we declare that motion carried. Thank you, councillors. Agenda item 6.4, draft parking and curbside management plan. I'm going to call on Crystal Maynard to come up and give us a brief presentation on what is a significant piece of work. So Crystal, please come on up. And then we'll hear from our members of the public this evening. Well, you can stand wherever you like.
Yes. I might stand here and talk to her. Great. Thank you, Lord Mayor, Deputy Lord Mayor and councillors. G'day, everyone. You've already met me. I'm Crystal. I'm the Director of Parking Services at the City of Melbourne. And I'm really excited to give you an overview of the draft parking and curbside management plan that's being considered tonight for community engagement. So, next. Thank you. We know that public space in a busy city is limited and in high demand. You'll be really surprised to hear that curbside space makes up only 4% of the city's street space. Yet it's critical to the functionality of the city, and it's a vital space for people and goods in and out. Next slide. The The City of Melbourne's Transport Strategy 2030 identified that our curbside space needs to be more proactively managed to optimise the use of its limited space. Next slide. We're really excited to hear from the community throughout the public consultation period, but here's a snapshot of what we've heard of the problems to date. Customers sometimes have difficulty finding a space. The signage is confusing. The rules are complicated. The price of parking doesn't fairly represent the value of the space. There can be difficulty finding available loading zones at some locations and times, and accessible parking isn't meeting all user needs. Next slide. So, we undertook a survey of 1,000 people who use paid parking. Based on each respondent's last trip to the city, which required them finding parking, we found that for every 100 of these customers, only 5 cars went straight to off-street parking. 95 cars cruised the street looking for an on-street space. Of those 95 cars, 82 found it difficult or very difficult to find a space, and 36 of those cars ended up going to an off-street car park. That's a lot to take in. So have a look at the plan, that's all in there. 59 cars either found an on-street space, parked illegally, or travelled further away than they intended to. What does that say? Our service isn't reliable and our customers are frustrated. Vehicles are cruising the streets. This adds to congestion and additional vehicle emissions and impacts road safety for city and amenity. Next slide, please. Tidbit for you. There are 70,000 commercial off-street parking spaces in the city. Getting more people to use that is an important outcome for this plan. On-street parking makes up only 5% of the total parking capacity in the city of Melbourne. Did you know that we only have 1,800 paid parking spaces in the CBD? 1,500 spaces on top of the 1,800 are used for loading zones, accessible parking, public transport stops, construction zones, and a range of other uses. Next slide, please. So what does the draft plan propose? We've got 7 strategic directions to improve curbside management in the City of Melbourne. We're going to shift our approach to the management of curbside space being a more strategic and data-led one. We'll put customers at the centre of our decisions about parking and be transparent about the data that we use to inform those decisions. We also know that we can no longer set and forget. The city continues to grow and change, and our parking settings in each neighbourhood should be regularly reviewed to ensure that they reflect that. We're going to deliver a financially sustainable parking service, and we'll ensure that the city's strategic commitments to sustainability and a livable and prosperous city are delivered alongside this plan. We want to encourage more drivers to consider the alternatives to street parking, including using off-street. So I really do encourage everyone to engage through this consultation period. Thank you.
Thank you, Crystal. Councillors, any questions for Crystal at this stage? No, thank you. Good. Appreciate that. We're now going to have some submissions from those that registered. Now, Damien Condonotto had requested to speak via Zoom, but we are unable to facilitate that, so Ed Legden has agreed to jump up, I believe, and speak or sing on behalf of the Motorcycle Riders Association. Ed, welcome.
Yes, it's been quite a night, I must say. We've spent time in Rodgers. Well, Damien is alive and well, and we'll hear from him tomorrow and the days progress, because, as usual, like a dog with a bone. But so he said, just on the phone, that he said something to the committee tomorrow. But I've got a few notes here. Damien and the rest of the NRA, and I'm a member, we're two wheels sort of people and two legs sort of people. I can't hear my tram today, but we think that for every car space, you know, there can be a space for 6 bikes. One of the things on this plan which is put out was that we should go to our commercial parking friends and pay up to them. I think as well as pushing cars there, we should try to encourage them to take in motorcycles as well in their discreet little places here and there. It's even now, Damien was telling me, sometimes the gate won't respond to a motorcycle device, it's just go around the gate and more or less don't pay. But there must be a way that we can get into the car parks. I mean, fair enough, we can park on the footpath or under an overhang or in our favourite place where it's not in anybody's way, etc., etc. But you could place a nominal amount for the car parks for the security of it, you know, cameras everywhere, being a little bit undercover and being with other people. The thing with the bikes that we own, we value them, we ride them, they're our things like a horse, if you like. And so, as opposed to a hire bike or an e-bike or e-scooter, which nobody really owns, which are left on the streets everywhere, and I've got photos of them in the Yarra again, the scooters replacing the bikes. And I just think that most rides are responsible. It's their bike. If somebody tips it over, there's $10,000, $5,000 gone down the train. So they'll park sensibly between places and so forth and so on. On the other hand, we understand that there are footpaths and places like Spencer Street Station and everywhere else where it's mighty difficult. And the average smart rider's never going to park there anyway. And I've noticed the signs have gone up. Motorcycles do not park here, and I think that's fair enough. There's always hot areas where we shouldn't be. And then any fool riders in time will get booked for that. But I think we're battling for the sensible riders have been parking on footpaths and parking sensibly since 1906 or something in Elizabeth Street and everywhere else.
Well done, okay. Ed. Oh, I'm sorry. I took that pause.
That's my lot.
Well done, and thank you for stepping in at the last minute and being also so entertaining for us this evening. We do appreciate it. Excellent. Thank you. I'm going to call on Dr. Gary O now to come and speak with us. You can stand wherever you like, actually. Good. You are our adjunct senior research fellow from the Monash Institute of Transport Studies. And we're really pleased to hear from you tonight, Gary. Thank you.
I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land, the Wurundjeri and Wurrung people of the Eastern Kulin Nation. I'd like to pay my respects to the elders, past, present, and moving. And I'd like to extend that respect to any Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander people in the world today. So, at Monash Institute of Transport Studies, we've had a look at the draft plan. It's pretty much consistent with the infrastructure of Victoria, transport network pricing recommendations in terms of trying to manage demand rather than build our way out of congestion. I do have some comments about the plan which I'd like to talk about, and also something about some of the work we're doing using the City of Melbourne Station. So, the plan has been tabled tonight, but the parking data, which the council offers to the public on its open data portal, doesn't seem to be up to date. It seems to be like pre-traded sort of information. So, if you're tabling the plan, the data that goes along with it should be up to date. So, we can talk about the circuits. We can't update our transport micro simulation models using pre-traded data. We have access to Vicro and SCATS data for the intersections, but we can't actually get parking information. So it'd be great if that data source could be updated. The second comment is around some of the information provided in the plan in there. So we undertook our own research in terms of trying to uncover the source of some of the statistics which that plan was drawn from. And we came across the SF Park evaluation in San Francisco and there, and we've come across some statements in there which I think need clarifying and correcting, just in case it leads to some misperceptions. Overall, I think it's a great plan to look, and I hope it goes well.
Thank you, Gary. Very interesting, and appreciate your inputs and overall endorsement, but also keeping us accountable and transparent. And I think some of those prompts are valuable to us as well. Data and evidence-driven reports, it's important to make sure they're up to date and we've got the right sources. And we have an open data platform, so we want to make sure that's useful for you as well in terms of updating, so we can have a look at those. Thank you very much. Were there any other questions? very nice.
Will that be provided in writing?
In writing?
Yes.
Yeah, the feedback?
It has.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. Now we're going to hear from David Hamilton, who's the president of Southbank 3006. Welcome, David, to speak on this issue. Present from wherever you like.
Thank you, Lord Mayor. Look, firstly, we think this is a really great piece of public policy from the council. And this is probably one of the best plans that I've seen come forward from the council. It's a really well-researched piece of work, so thank you very much. The first thing we'd like to say is that we are heartened that paragraph 6.3 now enables the council to address a major issue in South Bank, that is the conversion of curbside parking into open space, which is something we've argued for some time. We've got an abundance of off-street parking, private and public, and we've got a dramatic shortage of open space. So this gives an opportunity to transfer some of that resource into the open space that we really need in South Bank. The second issue I wanted to target was an issue about electric vehicles. And it's quite interesting that electric vehicles actually haven't formed a part of this policy, even though the council has really strong policies about climate change and about addressing climate change in its own in assets. And these assets of the street could be used to provide an electric vehicle parking policy, not charging spaces. We don't need that. We don't need destination charging. We don't need high-speed charging. But you could provide EV cars with the capacity to either double time or have free parking. The government has a policy to drive 50% of new vehicle registrations in the state to be EVs by 2030. This would be a really highly visible and low-cost initiative by the council so that it could present itself that this is something about EV and it is doing something consciously to enable and attract EVs. We know from your other examples overseas that where you remove fees, where you remove tolls, the take-up of electric vehicles rises dramatically. And the key example of that, obviously, has been Norway. So, councillors, I ask you to do that. There are a couple of other matters that we've addressed in our submission, which relate to parking enforcement and the issues of how do you deal with the construction sites. And we'd like that to become part of how do you use the neighbourhood portal. Thank you very much, and I really congratulate councillors and the council staff for this really fantastic piece of work. So thank you.
Thank you, David. You've made some great points there, and our feedback has already started. So thanks to all of the speakers this evening, and we're looking forward to you being involved in the process that is to follow. Well, look, I'm going to move this motion this evening and I'm seeking a seconder to the motion. Councillor Griffiths, thank you very much. As Lord Mayor, I want to acknowledge that this parking and curbside management plan and of course the feedback that we want to receive during this consultation period, these two combined are going to help us make better decisions about how we can use what is limited and highly contested space in our city. I want to say thank you to Crystal and the team, everybody who's been involved in pulling this report together. We've across the organisation been collecting evidence and data information to pull together a plan that provides some suggestions but really has a lot of provocations and open questions to encourage feedback
from our stakeholders in the city so that we can make better decisions into the future. For us, this is absolutely imperative that in addition to the data and evidence, we get that feedback from stakeholders, which is why we are promoting this consultation element so loudly. We acknowledge that this plan is part of our transport strategy to 2030, so thank you to people for recognising the importance of this plan, but to acknowledge that as part of that forward-looking strategic plan, being able to keep our city moving, literally by addressing parking, I know it sounds like an oxymoron, is something that was identified when we launched this plan, and I'm really grateful to all of the work that went into that transport strategy as it now continues to unfold into implementation. Now, we know at Town Hall that this is a very hot topic, parking, and one that affects Melburnians in one way or another, the way that we use this limited asset around our city. And we welcome that feedback, the debate and the input. As Crystal said earlier, we know that our current system needs improvement, and it's really time for us to take some big steps forward. Again, I'm going to repeat some of these because they're important. We have 10,000 on-street parks across the municipality. Only 1,800 of those are actually in the CBD, which is the most highly sought after real estate in our municipality, I would say almost in the state. With 95% of people that drive into the city looking for on-street parking, the maths just does not work. There is not a logical outcome to this conundrum as it currently stands. And what really came was a big revelation to me when the transport strategy was released was that 30% of the congestion experienced on our streets today in terms of traffic is caused by people going around the block and waiting for on-street parking spots to become available. It's a waste of time for the people looking for parking spots, and it causes massive congestion issues in our city. And if we can reduce this as a result of this review, it will be an enormous step forward. Further, with 80% of people disgruntled by the experience they have when they drive in, it is a no-brainer for us to come up with some simple, I know sometimes Crystal refers to them as tweaks. I think they're enormous steps forward. Even if they seem simple ways forward that we can improve people's experience. I encourage everybody to look at the draft range of potential improvements, to suggest other ideas, as we've already heard tonight. But we do suggest things like making signage simple. I have to say from my own experience, I have had tickets where I didn't think I deserved them. I misread the signs, and I guess if I can't work it out and I'm in and around the city every day, I think it does add to that frustration around town if we can't even understand the signs that are there to direct us. I think we can look for consistency in our approach across the city, which really streamlines our systems, which is also suggested. And we really have to do more. I'm taking this opportunity through consultation to talk more and more about off-street parking options, 70,000 commercial off-street parks, which are far more abundant than the 1,800 available on-street, more than 760,000 car trips done in the city every day, and we really need to encourage more people into off-street, and please know that we're engaging with those off-street commercial operators as part of this process. Now, I could talk for a long time because it's a great plan, but I did want to assure everybody, particularly if we were live streaming, that there is nothing in this plan that is about increasing our current hourly rate for parking. That is not the point here. In fact, there are suggestions to reduce hourly parking during low peak times or off peak times, but it is important that we're headlining with that so that we can take that sort of anxiety out of this process. We commend this report to our community as a major engagement and consultation over the next few weeks. I say thank you very much to everybody who's been involved in delivering this report to date. And thanks to councillors, because it has really been great internal debate to date. We've really pushed and shoved to get the best outcomes and thinking that we can. I feel really proud to move this motion this evening, reflecting that work and our ambition to engage so that we end up with better outcomes moving forward. Thank you, and I move to David Griffiths as seconder. Thanks.
Thank you, Lord Mayor. I think you've covered off every possible point there. No, that's a good thing, and emphasises the leadership role that you've played in this area as well. You're clearly very familiar with all of the many aspects of what is a very detailed document that's coming out. I would obviously like to add my thanks to yours for our team who have been doing all of the work behind the scenes, and indeed the team that did the work on the transport strategy that has borne some of the beginnings of this process. It's fantastic that there is an integrated approach across so many different aspects of what we're trying to do in terms of transport in the city, and this is an important component of that. And I think it's great to congratulate the officers, and the fact that our presenters tonight, or our community submitters, have been so generous in their praise of the document, I think is a fantastic example of how well received what you've put together will be by the community. So well done to our team, and thank you to our submitters who are here with us in person tonight for your suggestions, and please do pass on to Damien, who I know wrote documents to us beforehand that we've considered, that his contribution is valued as well, as what will be the start of a consultation process. And I think we've just got the smallest little flavour tonight of the wide range of areas of interest that this document will incite, and the wide range of experience and knowledge that people have to bring to bear on a discussion that's important as this one. Everything from universities through to users, even having a look at the online social media ads that we've put up for this today, and the summary of those, I think, at its most base level is change the... I was going to almost say a rude word there, because it's what happens on social media, I won't. People are equally frustrated about the signs, Lord Mayor, and look forward to them being simplified, and that is a message that on social media is often put very succinctly, and it's fantastic that people have already taken the time to feed back through that mechanism their views on the importance of what can be done around parking and curbside management in the city. Just like the neighbourhood plan, it's really important that we as councillors and as a council really sing from the rooftops the fact that this consultation is going on, and enable everyone in our community to be part of it. That's how we get the best ideas into the process, and that's how we'll end up with the best response when we conclude the process overall.
Thank you, Councillor Griffiths. I ask councillors, is there anybody else that would like to comment on this item? Councillor Leppett, thank you.
Thanks, Lord Mayor. I support this motion as well, and I think I agree with David Hamilton's suggestion that this is a really fine and one of the finest pieces of public policy to come out of the council. So I want to thank everyone involved. It is a beautiful thing. And I will leave my mind open enough to keep making improvements to this on the other side of the public consultation process. But the in principle support for this document that we're considering here today is significant. And I do think that is testament to the importance and significance and robustness of the transport strategy itself. This is a key document coming out of that strategy. There are other pieces of policy being developed by the city that also fall out of the transport strategy, but that 11-year mission to make sure that even though this is a metropolis that's 5 million plus and growing every day, that we are making sure that the centre of our city in particular is generating as much activity and economic uplift and safety and health and movement and congestion busting infrastructure as it possibly can. There's so many competing demands on those streets, and there's so many competing demands on the footpaths and the curbsides. And I think this draft plan, which includes policies around hierarchies of importance of different things we're trying to achieve, is a really beautiful way of setting out what the City of Melbourne's approach to all of these issues is going to be. I do wish that the live streaming was still on, Lord Mayor, because your speech was absolutely excellent, and it was full of quotable quotes. I'm grateful that it's off so that what I'm about to say won't be picked up, but in my ideal world, the easiest way to bust congestion is to price those on-street car parks at, I don't know, $1,000 an hour, $2,000 an hour. Maybe not that high, but the point is that if you want to reduce congestion as quickly as possible, you've got to understand the economics of parking, because reducing the doing the blockies, and Lord Met described it much more eloquently than I could, and allowing people to understand the plan in place to drive straight to that off-street car park and not clog up those local streets is, at the end of the day, the single biggest thing that can be done to reduce congestion on those streets as far as private vehicle travel is concerned anyway. That's obviously not in the realm of the politically feasible, but I do think that this is a plan that has a better grasp on parking economics than anything that's come before it. And I do think that its explanation of the way that we can look at dynamic pricing in the future, and yes, those upper prices won't go up, but those lower prices going up and down based on time of day and demand, that's where we have to move, because, you know, the city's getting bigger and the amount of road space hasn't increased since 1835. So this is a beautiful plan, and I really look forward to the public debate that's going to come in the weeks ahead.
Thank you, Councillor Leppett. Other speakers to the motion? No, then I'm going to put the motion to the vote. All those in favour, raise your hand. It's unanimous, we declare. That motion carried. Thank you, everyone. Well done, team. Agenda item 6.5 is Major Initiative 22 Design Excellence Program. Would councillors like a presentation on this item? No. Then I'm seeking a, let me double check that, seeking a councillor to move the motion. Deputy Lord Mayor, thank you, and a councillor to second the motion. Councillor Leppett, thank you. Over to you, Deputy Lord Mayor, thanks.
Thanks, Lord Mayor. I'm absolutely delighted to be moving this item tonight, because after 12 months of operation, I think it's safe to say that our Design Excellence program at the City of Melbourne has been an absolute triumph. Been a great team effort by the City of Melbourne, including our Design Review Panel members, our Design Excellence Advisory Committee members, and of course the great team at the City of Melbourne, led by Jocelyn Chu, Bronwyn Hampton and Danielle Jewson. Thank you so much, and great to see you here tonight. The two programs we piloted under our Design Excellence program was the Melbourne Design Review Panel and the Design Excellence Advisory Committee. In terms of the Design Review Panel, it has had a provable positive impact on shaping and improving design outcomes on major developments and city shaping projects across the city. It's been well received by developers, who are hearing loud and clear that design and architectural excellence must be at the heart of what they do in our city. Not only that, the feedback we've got from those who've gone through our design review panel has been outstanding. Of the 12 projects which have gone through the design panel, 10 said that they recorded significant improvements as a result of going through the process. In terms of the Design Excellence Advisory Committee, that has fostered some important debates around city shaping strategies and emerging design issues. We have visited and debated innovation precincts, train station precincts. We've gone and looked at the undercrofts of Melbourne and I've got to say it's been one of the most enjoyable experiences of my time on council to participate in these discussions with some of Melbourne and Australia, and indeed in many cases the world's leading designers and city thinkers. So it's been nothing short of an absolute joy. Looking forward to next year, we will be launching our new design competitions program with the new design competition guidelines for major developments. And we've seen recently that design competitions can have a really strong positive impact with the outstanding result that I believe has been achieved with the new NGV contemporary building, the Fox Gallery. And so at the City of Melbourne, we'll be having more to say and do on that front in 2023. So I'll finish where I began by saying thanks to the City of Melbourne team. Thanks especially to those who are here tonight that have been part of it. And bring on 2023-4.
Thank you, Deputy Lord Mayor. Councillor Lippitt.
Thanks, Lord Mayor, and I completely agree again with the Deputy Lord Mayor. One of the reasons this has been such a successful program is not just that the resources have been put aside to ensure that the team is in place and ensure that the advisory committees are in place and we've drawn on best practice to build together that program, but because it's been led by a political champion, you can't actually do that without getting the best out of the council and the administration working together. At the forefront of the council's design agenda is the Deputy Lord Mayor, and I want to acknowledge his leadership in developing this program. Without it, we simply wouldn't be here. Some of our neighbouring councils don't actually have a city design function at all at the moment. And when you cross the border into some directions, the difference between what is possible at the City of Melbourne and what's possible elsewhere is quite stark. But I think the value of this program is just so demonstrated. I know there's 161 pages here, but it speaks volumes just how important design is to improving the quality of the decision, the quality of the public realm and the quality of design throughout the city. And it's decisions that pay dividends over the very, very long term. And so I think this is a really valuable and efficient thing that the city does. And I want to thank our team for overseeing quite a few practices that are well known throughout the industry as to how to do things well, but also completely new and innovative practices that have had to be designed for the city, given our rather difficult and constrained regulatory environment. We don't set the rules sometimes. We work within them, and we have to work by encouragement rather than mandating, but my goodness, we do that well. So I want to thank the team, and I look forward to the next financial year for more wins on the design excellence front.
Thank you, Councillor Lippitt. Are there any other speakers to this motion? Well, as last I get to say, just well done really to everybody in the program. The feedback we've received I think has been outstanding in terms of how this program has really added to the quality of what we see in terms of outcomes in our city. And I think the engagement and sense of combined interest in and investment in better design outcomes has been revealed and grown as a result of this program, which is absolutely fantastic. So, thank you to everybody involved. I'm really pleased to support this motion this evening. And from an idea, there's a great outcome. So well done, DLM. I'm going to put the motion to the vote. Those in favour, please raise your hands. It's unanimous. So we declare that, oh yeah, motion carried with a bit of pizzazz there. Thank you, everyone. Agenda item 6.6, Southbank temporary play court options. Would councillors like a presentation on this item? No. Well, we've got a couple of speakers, which is great. I'm going to call on Janine Patterson, Southbank 3000, to come and stand wherever you'd like to talk to us about this motion. Thank you, Janine.
Thank you.
Welcome back to the podium.
Thank you. Thank you. So it's a pleasure to be back in front of you all again to discuss the basketball court. As you would remember, I gave you a presentation on the basketball court at the November Future of Melbourne meeting we held in Southbank, and I'm delighted to announce that Southbank 3006 fully support the proposed temporary basketball court adjacent to the Melbourne Square. This is an excellent solution, and Council should be commended on their innovation in obtaining the commitment from the developer to assist with social infrastructure in the area. Whilst the original plan to activate the Kingsway Undercroft would be the best and most permanent solution, we are concerned that the Undercroft site may prove to be too hard to negotiate, take too long to deliver, and prove to be too expensive overall. Accordingly, to have a long-term fallback option, Council should continue to investigate the Kingsway Park, bordering Sturt Street and Kingsway, to provide a long-term solution for the permanent park or even a secondary play space. This will enable the area to be activated in addition to its current use by expanding it to be a play space and playground area. This is an ideal location due to the existing amenities such as bathroom facilities, barbecue facilities, and it activates a part of Southbank which is rapidly growing in population. This would also speak to the wider community of Southbank, but that would acknowledge that Southbank is greater than the City Road and Kavanagh Street block on the western side of Power Street, with a development away from Boyd Community Hub. Ultimately, we simply need this project to continue its current momentum so that the residents can enjoy this outdoor activity in Southbank once again.
Thank you, Janine. Terrific. And we're now going to hear from Tony Penner, President of Southbank Residents Association. Welcome, Tony.
Thank you, Honourable Mayor, Councillors. As we all know, open space in Southbank is a problem, has been a problem, and it's a problem because this council, as we know, have dropped the ball on providing adequate open space for the residents of Southbank. I think in part, we're trying to retrofit that now, it's causing problems, and I think in part the reason why we are in this position now is because in the Southbank Structure Plan 2010, past planners had saw that open space was provisioned in that plan with the city link debt covering. So in their mind, open space is covered, we don't have to think about it going forward. Where are we now? We're here trying to find solutions to problems. It's great that we are aware of the problems with the basketball court and how that was such a massive asset to the community. You will recall that I specifically came to this forum last year suggesting to talk to the Melbourne Square developers to say, hey, there's a block of land there where we could temporarily put a basketball court. It is exciting to see that you've taken that further, and it looks like now that might be a solution. The other solutions that were proposed, Boyd Park open space, one of those solutions there was to be part of the green space there. We did a survey, we surveyed our community through our membership base, our newsletters, and also all the social media channels throughout Southbank. We had one of the largest responses that we've ever had for a survey in Southbank from our residents, so that also shows how important this basketball court is. And I'll have you know that 70%, two-thirds of the respondents, 66, the respondents were against using the green open space for a temporary basketball court. So it's good to know that data. I didn't claim to know where this community would or wouldn't be on that because they're two very important issues. I did have a picture that I did ask to be displayed during my presentation. If you could have that up, please. There we go. Council need to be bold with their visions. They need to be bold with what they want to do. Here's a thought. How about we use that substation directly opposite Boyd and somehow try and use the roof space on that? It's a government infrastructure. Maybe we could use that for some open space for Southbank. We need to be bold. We need to be visionary. Maybe let's start having a conversation on using some of that space there. Potentially, if it doesn't pull through with the developer, I reckon a basketball court could go up there. Another option. Thank you.
Thank you, Tony. Excellent. Well, I'm going to move a motion this evening in relation to the courts, which is a bit different to what was published. Yep, that's good. Thank you. I'm moving this motion and I'm seeking a seconder. Councillor Griffiths? Good. Okay. Thank you. Well,
I want to start by saying thank you for all of the feedback and ideas that we get through Southbank 3006 and the Southbank Residents Association. And Tony, you did suggest this some time ago, and we have listened. Might have taken some time to act, but just to say thank you. We do listen and we appreciate the ideas that you bring to our forums. In this situation, I thought it was worthwhile just going back to remind ourselves of the history. I know everybody here knows the history, but sharing this broadly is important in an ongoing sense, which is why we've put some storyboards up in the park as well. Given that this is our highest density residential suburb and that there's a lot of misunderstanding about what's happening on open space around Boyd. Of course, it used to be a school. We were able to purchase and then develop the library into, develop the building of the school into a library and community hub based on the decision to sell that part of the Boyd precinct for development. And actually, if that had happened first and then we'd delivered the park and the library, there might be quite different conversations. But the way that it's worked out, it's happening after the communities had use of what was a temporary basketball court and other open space there for some time. And of course, have absolutely loved it, appreciated it. And it's certainly been clear to us and a demonstrated need for the community. But unfortunately, on the basis of decisions made previously, there is a development happening there now. I say unfortunately only in terms of residents feeling let down by that project, but actually in the delivery of it, there will be more affordable housing made available, there'll be more market housing made available, and there'll be more community space made available in this very special part of Melbourne, which we welcome as well. Given the fact that the Undercroft, Kingsway Northern Undercroft, is not yet ready, the need for a temporary solution whilst we work on that project, which is an agreed project, it is funded and it is going ahead, meant that reaching out to find a temporary solution for some extra basketball space was necessary. And four options considered by management with encouragement from community and councillors. And I'm really pleased that OSK, I know a number of councillors, including you, DLM, have been involved in discussions with other stakeholders in the area, including OSK, that OSK has put their hand up as a really good member of the Southbank community and said they do have some land available and they will actually pay to deliver a basketball court in that spot that will remain there whilst it's needed and the Undercroft is delivered. I think that is just a great demonstration of partnership between government, community and private sector, and we're really pleased, I am, to move this motion this evening so that the team can continue to work with OSK and get this court delivered as quickly as possible. The fact that it is proximate to the court that has gone as PDG develops that new building, I think is good, because those local users will see that basketball court be delivered, but points noted in relation to other areas, both of you in the vicinity. For these reasons, I'm really happy to move this evening, and I go to you, Councillor Griffiths, as seconder. Thank you.
Thank you, Lord Mayor, and I share your happiness and excitement that this work is going ahead. I'd also like to thank the community groups that have stayed on us and made sure that we delivered on this front. It's been a community-led response, and I think it's been fantastic to see the tenacity that has come from the local community and the value clearly that is placed on these kinds of facilities. It's something that, as a councillor and as a council, is really, really great to see that there's so much local engagement and that eventually we've been able to deliver on this with some partners. And I hope that these facilities are ones that will not only be enjoyed by the local community and it be a place that people can gather and enjoy themselves, but that that also contributes to the health and well-being of people in the community. That's one of the important aspects of our council plan and the health and well-being plan that's contained within it. Good facilities are a vital part of that, particularly in areas like South Bank where they're so needed. So I can assure you that there are few parts of the municipal map that are poured over more than South Bank as we look for opportunities to do things like this and other open space options. And I really commend this motion to the council tonight.
Thank you, Councillor Griffiths. Are there any other speakers? Deputy Lord Mayor, thank you.
Thanks, Lord Mayor. I am delighted to be able to speak to this motion and also pick up a couple of the comments that we've heard tonight. I agree with Janine and Tony and David that we heard from earlier that South Bank is a fantastic part of Melbourne. I work there. I love it. But it is an area that does have some challenges from an urban planning perspective, beginning with the fact that for 150 years it was an industrial and warehousing area. Now it's become Australia's most densely populated suburb. And so we are doing the very difficult job of trying to retrofit a lot of the services and spaces that Melburnians should have and deserve to have in the world's most livable city. But it does mean that it does take quite a lot of hard work on part of the city to achieve some of these outcomes. So I do accept that there's often some frustration out there at how the pace of things, and I also accept that there have been mistakes made as well. But I really want to put it on the record that tonight this is a great outcome. This is an example of a council which listens and acts. And we heard loud and clear at that community forum that the problems around the basketball courts could not have been clearer. And since that, you know, moment of inspiration, there's been a lot of perspiration as we have literally trawled every square inch of South Bank to see if we could find a new location to build some new facilities. And to their absolute credit, Cox Architects, who do a lot of work in South Bank, they've been helping out. They do some work with OSK, helped facilitate some connections there, and again led to a lot of discussion, which has meant that tonight we're able to vote and say, yes, let's proceed with the pursuit of option 4 and deliver at least one new basketball court for South Bank. Now, the work, which is, it's a brilliant result, like it really is, given where we found ourselves at the night of the community meeting. Now, the work doesn't end there. There's still more to go. Again, there's not a square inch of South Bank which we aren't looking at closely for new opportunities for recreational space, green space and sporting space. And, you see the Northern Undercroft site here. Mentions one of the options. I think, it's an open secret. There will be more to say about that very soon. So, look, things are moving in a positive direction. It's not easy, but tonight's a good night and there's more good news to come. Thanks, Lord Mayor.
Thanks, DLM. Any other speakers to this motion? Nope, then I'm putting the motion to the vote. All those in favour, dribble. No, put your hands in the air. That, as in dribble the ball, that is, yeah. yes, thank you. It's unanimous. We declare the motion carried. Thank you, everybody, for being involved in that matter. It brings us to agenda item 6.7 on reports from management, funding support requests March 2023. Would councillors like a presentation on this item? No, thank you. Then I'm going to move this motion and I'm seeking a seconder to the motion. Thanks, Councillor
Dr. Ball. There is the motion on the screen. It is referring to support for the National Child and Youth Homelessness Conference 2023, being held in the city on the 5th and 6th of June this year, and support value of $25,000. I think, as everybody here knows, ending homelessness is a priority for the City of Melbourne, and our Homes Melbourne team are working across many projects, programs, and with many partners to see how we can deliver on our affordable housing strategy, which includes seeing more affordable housing built in the City of Melbourne, which includes our daily support teams going out to assist rough sleepers with their needs and pathways out of homelessness, and to ensure that they're accessing appropriate support. It does also include efforts around the delivery of Make Room as a facility for people experiencing homelessness, co-located with support services to assist with long-term pathways to housing. And we do acknowledge that if we can break the cycle of youth and child homelessness, not just in our city, of course, but starting with our city, then that has major benefits, of course, for those people experiencing homelessness, but for the community beyond that. It stops a lifetime of issues in many cases. And I note that we have been approached on this by Elvis Martin, who is somebody with lived experience as a youth experiencing homelessness, who's been a great leader in our City of Melbourne at raising awareness, at advocating for change, and for following through in terms of seeing programs delivered. So we thank him for bringing this opportunity to us to become a sponsor, where we know that this conference will be having important discussions, will be suggesting solutions, and that we can continue to work together with the relevant stakeholders to really make an impact on something that really is unacceptable in a community that's not just affluent like ours, but is as caring as we are. We can see change, and this conference will help us move towards that more quickly and more effectively. Enough said, I absolutely support this recommendation and motion, and I'm pleased to move it. And to you, Councillor Dr. Ball, as seconder. Thank you.
Thank you, Lord Mayor. I have nothing to add, but very happy to second this motion.
Thank you. Are there any other speakers to this motion? Then I put it to the vote. All those in favour, put your hand in the air. It's unanimous, so we declare that motion carried. Thank you, councillors. Well, that concludes reports from management this evening. But before you go anywhere, there is one item of general business. And it is 7.1, Notice of Motion, Lord Mayor Sally Capp, an Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander voice to Parliament. And I'm going to call now on Chris Strum, who has requested the opportunity to address the committee at this point. Chris, you can do it from where you are if you like, given we've got no microphone. Thank you, Chris.
Thank you, Lord Mayor. Lord Mayor, Sally Capp, Deputy Lord Mayor, Nicholas Rees, councillors, men and women, the City of Melbourne, we're on Wurundjeri country. We respect elders past and present. And this is about an Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander voice to the Parliament. And I fully support Lord Mayor Sally Capp's endeavour to support and have this enshrined in the Constitution of Australia. When Sally Capp became Lord Mayor, a few days after she was Lord Mayor, she spoke at the Long Walk, and she spoke very eloquently. It was one of her first public engagements, and people were very appreciative of her sentiment and the words that she expressed then. And what she expressed was a continuation of things like, we remember Gough and the work that he did with Vincent Wangari. We remember Paul Keating and the courage he showed in 1993 at Redfern when he made a tremendous speech to highlight the plight and the situation of First Nations people. Now, Paul Keating spoke the truth. He told it how it is. He raised the awareness in the Australian community of what went down and what was occurring for First Nations people now. And so I do thank Paul Keating for his courage. I'd like to thank Aldo too for his embrace of the Uluru Statement of the Heart. I'd like to thank the City of Melbourne too for printing up the Uluru Statement of the Heart in this item as well. So we need to walk together on this one. Now, we don't have to be fearful of First Nations people or their elders. We should actually embrace their culture and actually listen to what they're talking about. I'd also like to thank Malcolm Turnbull. He once flew down from Sydney to a crappy, grey, miserable Melbourne Wednesday day to attend the Long Walk. And he supported Michael Long that day. And I remember Malcolm Turnbull, he said, it's very important that I be here today to support Michael Long and his endeavours for what he's trying to achieve. So what Sally Capp is doing here is she's furthering on the work that Michael Long undertook to try and further improve every Australian's life. So I thank you for your time. And let's walk together on this one. We can do it.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you. We really value your input on this topic in particular tonight and your leadership in our city too, Chris. Thank you. Well, I'm going to move this motion this evening, and I'm calling on Councillor Dr. Ball to second the motion. Thank you. I'm going to speak to it, and I really want to start by saying that even though my name is there, and Chris, thank you for your comments as well, I lead the Aboriginal Melbourne portfolio. Councillor Dr. Ball is deputy lead, and Councillor Dr. Ball's been absolutely instrumental in pushing this motion along, so I really wanted to acknowledge that. Councillor Dr. Ball, and I know you'll have some important things to say this evening as well. I said it at the start of the meeting, as we do at the start of every one of our council meetings and FMCs, that the City of Melbourne is committed to governing with Aboriginal people. And tonight we particularly note that we support the Uluru Statement from the Heart. And this is really critical from my perspective on how I have come to this position. Because the Uluru Statement from the Heart was created and signed following detailed, passionate, thoughtful discussions from representatives of Aboriginal people from across Australia in 2017. And Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, I should say, from across Australia in 2017. And I acknowledge that tonight because of the work that was put into developing and agreeing the Uluru Statement, that incredible leadership shown by Indigenous Australians to pull that statement together. And it's a meaningful statement. It's an invitation to the Australian people from our First Nations Australians to undertake a series of reforms. Voice, treaty and truth. And they are the key pillars of the Uluru Statement and the outcomes being sought. The Uluru Statement since then has continued to have broad support across not just traditional owner groups, but I think very well received across Australian communities, and certainly within our municipality, it's been a guiding light on many of the discussions that we've had as we've shaped our own plans and actions in relation to reconciliation and how we can do better. The upcoming referendum represents an opportunity for us to discuss and potentially progress, I hope, the first of those three pillars in the Uluru Statement, and to do that together, all Australians being involved in that debate and that change. And as with any significant change, I completely acknowledge that there will be a diversity of views, and that's expected. And we're seeing that already in the discussions and the debates. That is the nature of being in a democracy, which we love. And that is, of course, within First Nations communities as well as other communities across the country. However, the motion this evening is a way that we bring together as a council our belief in line with our commitment to truth-telling, to reconciliation and governing with Aboriginal people, that it's important to affirm that the City of Melbourne is supportive of the principles of the Uluru Statement from the heart, and the Yes campaign in particular as we go into the referendum, that we are supporting the Yes campaign, and that's what this motion is about. This motion also sets out, as many other councils around Australia have done, an obligation and a responsibility that we have a practical role to play in what is a national debate and a national government led reform. But our practical role over the next few months is to help ensure that our community is engaged and connected and informed about the debate, about every aspect of the debate. That really is an important role that we can play to ensure that people participate in this very significant discussion. That's got to be the first hurdle, is participation and informed participation in this referendum. And that's why we are also suggesting in this motion, or expecting, that our team, if it's passed, will go ahead and develop and deliver a program where we can inform and stimulate the engagement of Melburnians in this discussion, which I welcome and look forward to as well. Such an important part. And referendums don't happen very often. It is important that we are all involved. And I often say, I've got a citizenship ceremony tomorrow, that one of our rights and responsibilities as members of the Australian community is to make sure that we leverage and maximise our individual voices as we shape the future of our nation together. And from my perspective, this referendum is one of the most critical in our lifetimes. And so I'm really happy to move this motion this evening. To you, Councillor Dr. Ball, thank you.
Thank you very much, Lord Mayor. I hope you can hear me. This is a really important night for us. It's a step along a very long journey, and we need to acknowledge the centuries of struggle from the First Nations, the hundreds of First Nations of this continent that bring us to this point. We acknowledge that not the entire Aboriginal community is not unified in its position, as it wouldn't be on any position in any community, but on the basis of a strong majority and some very strong leading voices, one of which I hoped to play to you tonight, Professor Megan Davis, you may be familiar with as one of Australia's leading international human rights lawyers and a strong proponent of the Uluru Statement. I wanted to possibly freak out the meeting procedures experts amongst us by playing to you a recording of her reading the Uluru Statement from the heart. Because we don't have microphones and audio tonight, I can't do that. But If you haven't read the Uluru Statement, it is one page long. It is extraordinarily articulate and eloquent and a beautiful piece of writing. It is a very moving piece, commentary on where we are today in race relations in this country. And it is an extraordinarily generous, magnanimous statement of invitation. I would urge you, if you do one thing after this meeting, if you haven't already read the Uluru Statement, to find it and to read it. You can find it at ulurustatement.org. But I really wanted you to hear it read. There are those who say that it's much more powerful, especially for those of us who are non-Indigenous, to hear that invitation spoken to us, that we are invited to respond. If there is anyone Aboriginal here tonight who would like to read it to us, I dare say I would have you volunteer and read the statement to us. However, please go and read it for yourselves, ulurustatement.org. And if there's a second thing you do tonight, in terms of educating ourselves about our history, that truth component that is central to the Uluru Statement, one thing you could do is look on SBS On Demand and watch a three-part documentary called The Australian Wars. When I was an international student studying human rights many years ago, when I couldn't study it here, I went abroad to study human rights, and people abroad said to me, why did Aboriginal people not fight back when Britain came and colonised Australia? And if you watch The Australian Wars, you'll see, of course, that Aboriginal people did fight for their country, did fight for their survival, did fight for themselves and their cultures and their family and their women and their children. And of course, there are many other instances of intercultural connection that were not by nature conflictual and aggressive, in the whole rich texture of our history that we need to understand and own. So those three elements we are committing council to tonight, if this motion passes, and of course I urge my colleagues to support this motion, those three elements from the Uluru Statement we support in full: truth, treaty and voice. What we have available to us in the proposed referendum for constitutional amendment is that voice element, and we are committing to the referendum as well as the Uluru Statement. I dare say if we didn't have this voice, if this referendum does not pass and we do not create this body, which we're dubbing the voice, we would have to create a different kind of body or a similar kind of body, another representative Aboriginal body, in order to pursue treaty. So there are different ways we could achieve these three elements: truth, treaty and voice. What we have on the table tonight for us as a nation is a referendum on voice. I don't know if any of you are already aware, we have a voice in Victoria. It's not called the voice, it's called the First Peoples Assembly. But we already, in our state, have an equivalent body that is a representative organisation of Aboriginal people organising amongst themselves, representing themselves and treating, the verb, with the government on the just future of race relations in Victoria. And the house, the sky hasn't fallen in. Many people are not aware. We already have a voice in Victoria, and we can have a voice nationally. We already have a truth commission in Victoria, the Yuruk Justice Commission, which is holding witness testimony, truth panels throughout the state. We ourselves as a council will be contributing to that truth commission, and it is taking testimony across the state so that we all put on the record. It's very important that it is recorded and that we understand our own history. So these activities, these three activities, treaty making, truth telling and a representative body of Aboriginal people advising government, is already happening in Victoria, and it can happen. And I fervently hope it will happen nationally. We do that, of course, through a constitutional amendment which requires a referendum. We've been promised a referendum at the end of this calendar year, and we will be working to educate our community in what this means, which we start here tonight. You have your two pieces of homework, and I look forward to the campaign that we devise and propagate amongst the community and engaging in this debate that we all need to have on this fundamentally important historical question and moment for us as a nation. And thank you.
Thank you, Councillor Dr. Ball. Are there any other speakers to this motion? Councillor Hakim.
Thank you, Lord Mayor. I just want to briefly say that there are certain times when we need to stand up, and this is one of those times. I'm proud that today we as a city are considering this question and putting forward a motion that not just makes our position clear, but makes sure that we are strong in our stance. There is clear support through the Uluru Statement of the Heart for Truth, Treaty and Voice. This is towards one of those, and that's our start, and we have to take a step at a time to achieve the ultimate outcomes. I'll be supporting this motion. Thank you.
Thank you. I kept reaching for the microphone switch habit. That's right. Thank you, Councillor Hakim. Councillor Griffiths.
Thank you, Lord Mayor, and thank you to, first of all, Chris for his submission tonight, and excellent to be reminded of the long history that these issues have in our country and in our politics. And thank you to the Lord Mayor and the councillors who've spoken tonight, particularly Councillor Dr. Ball, for your contribution there. It is such an important time for individual councillors to be standing up for what they believe in a forum like this, and for our organisation, our institution, to show leadership in our country on what is a profoundly important issue. And this opportunity to speak tonight is one that I think it's fantastic to see so many contributions already. We are looked to as an institution by the people of Melbourne and more broadly as one that can provide leadership on key issues in our society. And it's hard to think of one that could be more important than what's being debated tonight. I was reflecting in the last 24 hours or so on the history of referendums in our country, and part of the reason for that was the news recently that Terry Norris, who some of you might know, has passed away, and he was a former parliamentarian, former Kensington resident who I knew way back in the day, and I had the pleasure of campaigning around the Republic referendum with Terry. And amongst my happy memories of Terry and others literally breaking out of hospital on the day of the referendum to come and hand out down around the Kensington Flats and the Flemington Flats. Why did they want to engage, not just at that time, but in that place? Because they saw a key part of their advocacy was around talking to the newest residents in Australia about the importance of referendums and our capacity to change our constitution and change our society through peaceful legal means. And I think it's worth reflecting on the fact that that referendum, although it failed, in 1999, we were faced with a very different worldview. I was listening to a podcast the other day. I hadn't really thought about it, but in the 90s, the number of democracies in the world doubled. And there was a different feeling in the world about how change can occur and how people can affect the societies that they live in. That we live in a different world now. We don't necessarily have that optimism worldwide around democracies. Here in Australia, here in Victoria, here in Melbourne, we have something which is really precious. The capacity to change some of the most profound ways that we run our society through peaceful means. And I think that as part of our messaging to our constituents and people more broadly across Melbourne, Victoria and Australia, there's a fundamentally important message to get out there, which is that here is an opportunity to change the society that you live in, and particularly if you're a recently arrived migrant to Australia, if you're not familiar with the fact that these things are possible, that this is one of the great joys, as you say, Lord Mayor, one of those things that citizenship opens the door to. And I think that that is a really important message as part of what we're talking about with our constituents, to encourage them to be part of this process, no matter where they arrive ultimately on the answer to the referendum, but to be part of it and to participate in one of these incredibly meaningful moments that will occur in our society. Once every 25 years, these opportunities come around. So I really encourage people, everyone in this room tonight, to do Dr. Ball's homework. I thoroughly endorse that homework, but then to go out and encourage every one of your neighbours to be part of this process and to be part of what will be a chance to shape our society in a fundamentally important and meaningful way.
Thank you, Councillor Griffiths. Any other speakers? Councillor Leppert. I'm loving the speeches, so let's keep going. Councillor Leppert.
Well, the first thing I was going to say, Lord Mayor, was that that was four of some of the finest speeches I've heard in my 10.5 years as a councillor, and I cannot possibly rise to that standard. So perhaps instead of quality, I'll just keep it as brief as I can. But I wanted to thank you, Lord Mayor, for your leadership on this issue. This isn't a conversation at a level of maturity and healthiness that is being had at other levels of government and or even being had at most councils. It's being had in some institutions, but normally for a national debate like this, you would have hoped, or I would have hoped, that there'd be more of the speeches of the type that we heard from you and also Dr. Ball and Councillor Hakim and Councillor Griffiths. So thank you, Lord Mayor, for your leadership on this matter. I'm so very happy and proud to be associating myself with this motion as well. I do acknowledge that this is a national conversation that is incredibly complicated and diverse, and this motion before us acknowledges that complexity, the multi-layered nature of this this debate. I'm conscious as well as a member of the Greens that there's different expectations placed on all of us, well, whether I'm a Green or whether outside the party, as to what our response to Aboriginal communities should be. It strikes me that the voters on this referendum will not only be Aboriginal people and will not only be people deciding to issue their votes as a proxy for whatever emerges as a consensus view. I've always taken the view that just as it's inappropriate to wait for Aboriginal Australians to come up with a position that 100% agree with, it's impossible to wait for non-Aboriginal Australians to all agree to vote for the same political party. That is not going to happen, and it is an incredibly immature approach to take to say that those of us who are not Aboriginal Australians should not or cannot contribute to the debate or should not or cannot listen to particular communities within that debate. So I'm conscious of the role as a non-Aboriginal person that I have, but I also sincerely support the proposal before us because to win a national debate, you have to build the momentum. That momentum has to come from all quarters, Aboriginal communities and institutions that haven't always had Aboriginal members on them, and this is one of those institutions. But as the Lord Mayor said, this is a gesture and an offer from the finest or the biggest consensus that we've seen in a generation, and it is something that we should be embracing and platforming as much as we possibly can. So I not only support the voice and the challenge that's issued to us in the Uluru Statement from the heart and all elements of the statement, but acknowledge that we do have a role to not just facilitate the debate, but lead the debate here in Melbourne. Acknowledge the diversity of views, acknowledge the complexities, acknowledge that throughout this debate, like other national debates, people will be differently affected by that debate. But as the City of Melbourne, as a leading institution, we do have a role to play and we shouldn't shy away from that. And again, I wish that the live stream was working so that some of your words, Lord Mayor, could be in the press, because this is the decision isn't really being made here in this room right now. This is a matter that is going to be one that we all need to focus on between now and the date of the referendum. I look forward to contributing to that debate in as mature and respectful a way as possible, but I'm delighted that the City of Melbourne is deciding to take a leadership role in that debate here and now, and I look forward to voting for the motion.
Thank you, Councillor Leppett. Deputy Lord Mayor.
Thanks, Lord Mayor. Can I also begin by thanking you for your leadership on this matter? It's been absolutely outstanding. And I want to thank Olivia Ball for the energy and effort and passion that she has put into this as well. And I want to put on the record that it's been one of my most heartening experiences as a councillor to see the way that councillors have really rallied around on this. And everyone has actually contributed in some way, I think, to the motion that's now before us. And I hope for those of you who are present, you see in this motion and in your councillor community representatives that we are a group of people who do think deeply about these things and lean in when it comes to progress on important matters such as this. Now, I do agree with the sentiment and the notion that this is arguably the most important vote that Australia will have in at least two decades. The character of our country is on the ballot. And if you think I'm exaggerating by saying that, if you doubt what I'm saying, just think for a second about how you will feel. Think about how Australia will feel if the votes no, if we fall short. How will we all feel the next day? And what will that say to the world about our country? Now, possibly the most debatable point in this motion is the fact that we are saying that we affirm our support for the Uluru Statement from the Heart and the Yes campaign for the constitutional recognition of that voice. So we're saying tonight that we're saying to Melburnians, you should vote yes. Now, there'll be some people who will say, well, how can you be doing that when you haven't yet seen the exact wording of the proposition? And, you know, for someone like me who, began my career as a solicitor, I think that there is some legitimacy from non-legal people who might ask that question. But the truth is, the final detail of the wording, and in fact the detail of how the voice is operationalised, will be decided by constitutional experts and by parliamentarians. You know, that's what we pay them to do. What we are going to be voting for is a principle. That's what referendum is about. You're voting for a principle. Are you for something or are you against it? And I hope, beyond hope, that the vote is for yes, because there's a very, very big principle at stake here. So I'm proud to be very shortly putting up my hand to support this motion.
Thank you, DLM. Any other speakers?
Go on, Councillor Deutsch.
I'll be quick, I promise. Thank you, Lord Mayor. I don't think there's much more to add to the wonderful words we've heard tonight, but I would like to lend my voice to the fact that absolutely I support the voice. Not just because it's important that we have the voice in Australia, but also it's our best opportunity to reach treaty. And I think that's absolutely the priority of everybody in this country. And I will not stop campaigning after this referendum to make sure that we reach treaty as soon and as quickly as possible and in the best interests of all Australians. Thank you. Nicely done.
Thank you, Councillor Deutsch. Well, there are no other speakers possible to this motion. We've all had a say, and I'm going to put the motion to the vote. All those in favour of this motion, please raise your hands. It's unanimous, so we declare that motion carried. Thank you to everyone here for listening through that debate and discussion amongst councillors. It does conclude items of general business, you'll be pleased to know, and I'm checking with councillors Are there any items of urgent business to discuss at this time? No, thank you very much. Well, that brings us to our question time that we have at the end of the meeting. We've allowed 15 minutes. If we need to extend that, we will. There are quite a few questions still to get through. Let's see how we go. It is 9:03, and I'm going to take us back to the fact that there were 8 public questions received relating to ATET and Docklands noise issues. 5 of those questions were submitted in writing, and I'm going to ask the Deputy Lord Mayor, who is Chair of our City Planning Portfolio Lead, to go through those questions. Thank you. If you are leaving at this point, thanks so much for your participation, and we completely understand. So thank you. Over to you, Deputy Lord Mayor.
Thank you, Lord Mayor. I'll now read out the written question that we have received from Joanne Bacon. Joanne asks, on the Tuesday 14 March meeting that was held with Docklands residents about ATET, while we were provided with time to air the detriment it is causing on the lives of many Docklands residents, there were no comprehensive answers given to the many questions asked. When will you be holding a follow-up meeting to answer many of these questions? We also have a similar question from Molly Burdett. Molly asks, regarding the Docklands Community Information Session held on 14 March for Docklands, will minutes be provided for this session? Will the residents have access to the same report summary compiled by the facilitator, which will be given to the council? If so, how will this information be provided to Docklands residents, specifically those who attended the meeting? Now, I have a response that has been prepared by our General Manager of Strategy, Planning and Climate Change, Evan Council, which I will read, and then I will add a little bit to that as well. All questions raised, and so Evan has written, all questions raised as part of the session have been captured, and while the focus of the responses on the night was on the main areas of concern, Council has committed to, firstly, respond in writing to all questions raised no later than 18 April 2023. This will be a coordinated response from City of Melbourne, Environmental Protection Authority, Department of Justice and Community Safety, and Victoria Police. It will include all questions and comments captured by the facilitators on the night. And secondly, we will communicate the outcomes of the investigations currently underway by the City of Melbourne and the Environmental Protection Authority 8 weeks from the information session, which would be at the latest the 9th of May 2023. The recording of the event can be found on the Docklands Community Information Session page and on the City of Melbourne website. Responses will be published online on the Docklands Community Information Session page and via Docklands Neighbourhood Portal when it is released. I will now read out the question written that we have received by Linda Eitelberg. While the noise in Docklands clearly is not under control, how will you tackle the new late night laws for venues to stay open late? What provisions are you taking to properly protect residents from noise pollution? The following response has been prepared by the General Manager of Strategy, Planning and Climate Change, Evan Council. He writes, Council currently has a local planning policy for licensed premises within the Melbourne planning scheme. In a separate report tonight, Council has considered the implications of removing the late night freeze with suggestions for additional land use changes to the Dockland zone to provide additional permit triggers for bars and nightclubs. That was the item we discussed at agenda item 6.2. I will now read the next question, which comes from Melanie Waddell. Melanie asks, whilst many councils have worked hard to consider the environmental impact of their residents and to take action to ensure their health and safety, why has City of Melbourne not taken equivalent action to safeguard their residents from the same environmental impacts? specifically noise pollution. Many areas have put up signs for trucks not to use engine brakes during normal sleep periods, if at all. Whereas City of Melbourne has not addressed this matter, even when raised. Residents of the Voyager building are impacted by noise from trucks' engine brakes at all hours of the day and night from the Balti Bridge and Lorimer Street. Likewise, residents across Docklands have been impacted by the nightclub Atet. And City of Melbourne's response has been to ignore the effect on residents and stick to the claim that it's okay as they are abiding by the rules, which has not always been the case. Why has City of Melbourne done nothing to address the impact on residents? Again, the following response has been drafted by General Manager of Strategy Planning and Climate Change, Evan Council. Management of noise from trucks' brakes on the Balti Bridge needs to be raised with the relevant state road authority, and this is a major arterial road and not a local road in a residential area where we often see the types of signs you refer to in your question. I can assure you that Council are not ignoring complaints raised in relation to a TET. We have taken specific action and have continued to investigate concerns raised as well as work with other agencies. And in addition to that, I believe Lorimer Street was mentioned. This is Councillor Rees speaking now. And so I believe Lorimer Street is a state road as well. But nonetheless, I would commit to Melanie Waddell that we would be happy to hear further from her about any noise from trucks, particularly those air brakes. I know how annoying that can be, and to the extent that we can detect truck noise on local roads and signage or other measures may be able to alleviate the situation, then we will most certainly be taking action. The next question is from Bill Thompson, a Docklands resident who is known well to many of us. In looking for solutions to the ATET noise problems at the Docklands, is the City of Melbourne and or the venue operator looking at the technical benefits offered by directional speaker systems, such as the JBN sound ceiling? Such systems have been extensively utilised locally and internationally to reduce noise to neighbourhoods by up to 12 to 15 decibels. This level of noise reduction could potentially resolve the distress being experienced by Docklands residents from the excessive and incessant noise being emitted by the ATET floating nightclub. A response has been prepared by General Manager Strategy Planning and Climate Change, Evan Council. He writes, I can confirm and note that this was raised at the recent information session in Docklands. And council officers and the EPA have recently met with the venue operator to explore available options for noise mitigation. This included exploring whether directional speakers would assist in reducing the noise. These ongoing discussions will form part of the current investigations. And I, Councillor Rees, would like to add to Evan Council's response there by saying thank you, Bill, for actually bringing the idea of directional sound and some of the new speaker technologies that are available to our attention. It has certainly caught my attention and that of the Lord Mayor and councillors, I know, and the officers are right onto it as well. And this is something that is being very, very actively investigated by our officers and in discussion with the owners and operators of ATET. Before we now continue, I wouldn't mind just quickly adding one final point from me, and that is to say that Lord Mayor, myself, Councillor Griffiths, Councillor Hakim, and many others here tonight were at the Docklands community meeting the other week. It was a robust exchange, as we all expected. But it was a good discussion. I do understand the frustration of some of the participants, that there was a lot of questions asked. and some people felt that there weren't enough answers. But from a City of Melbourne perspective, it was still very, very helpful because it did allow for a clear distillation of the issues and put a very clear focus on what needs to be done. There was a commitment that I made that I know councillors agreed with on the evening that the current situation is unacceptable. The current situation cannot continue and that we are going to do everything that we can to fix it. And I do note that the owners of ATET and operators, Jake and his mum and dad were there. They heard that message very clearly. It was disappointing that we have had further noise complaints since then, but I do want anybody who is following this debate to know that there is a laser-like focus on resolving this issue. Back to you, Lord Mayor.
Thank you, Deputy Lord Mayor. Now, do we still have Sandra here with us? Sandra, that is you.
Well done.
Thank you for lasting this long, and we are all here to listen to your questions this evening. So you can stand or sit wherever you like. Sandra, thanks for joining us. Engage
And so within current planning and permitting, therefore they have been delegated to an indoor permitted venue. As required, council laws, bylaws and guidelines evolve to ensure they keep pace with the needs and requirements of the developing communities which council serves. Why has council and DB and Planning Victoria not evolved laws, bylaws and permit categories which have kept pace with a different type of venue and have the contingencies in place to ensure the amenity of the area is ensured and the residents' ongoing enjoyment of their homes?
Thank you very much, Sandra. And there are a lot of questions there, some of which I think we'll need to take up at a time when we can provide you with more detailed responses. But just to touch on a couple of things, we are dedicated to green space. Well, firstly, we love Docklands. I pick up on some of your sentiments that you think that from time to time we're derisory in some way about Docklands. That's not the case at all. It's a very special part of our city, one that is deserving of, I don't want to say more than its fair share of attention, but we're certainly very aware that Docklands is an area that is deserving of investment and attention. There are plans and ongoing plans for delivery of green spaces. There's an initiative underway at the moment that was called for by residents down there that is underway around Harbour Esplanade, Yennanong Quay area, and that's one example. Another example that you mentioned was North Wharf and making that a family-friendly open space, and of course Green Line, which is anticipated, that last part on the south side of North Wharf, if that makes sense, all of which is built into Lendlease's development of that area, which I understand that they continue to plan for. Those plans aren't complete yet, but we encourage them to bring those plans to us as soon as possible so that we can work with them to deliver that family-friendly and those green open spaces. When I think about some of the other developments contemplated going forward, for example, the development over the current Woolworths being done by Ash Morgan over near the primary school, huge efforts done by officers and councillors to make sure that there was open space, even vertical open space, given that space is so tight there, so that we can maximise outcomes for community and the school in particular around green open spaces. And look, we'll just continue those efforts as Docklands unfolds. And I note that recently we signed off on the planning permit for the Goods Shed redevelopment, which will include new cultural space and the rejuvenation of those heritage sheds and bring more people to Docklands, which I know is something that we all support. In terms of keeping up with the needs, I think you heard this evening on the matter in relation to the lifting of the moratorium on late night liquor licences, that we are calling for our team to put work together to be able to advocate and negotiate to state government on appropriate planning rules around that policy so that we can better balance the needs of what business owners want to achieve on one side and the amenity for residents on the other. And frankly, that's a balance that we are working on in different ways every single day. So just to say that we're very familiar with it, and we understand the heightened issues in Docklands at the moment, and that's why it was so good that the EPA was there the other night, because ultimately they control what noise levels are appropriate in different settings. And as you said, they have not been revisited, I think, for decades, somebody may know, and it is time to do that in Docklands and other parts of the city as well, which is what is anticipated as part of the ongoing work. So our interest in and investment in Docklands as a thriving, vibrant place that has a mixture of workers, of residents and visitors is a priority for us. And in terms of those investments, of course, there's the fire, one of my favourite festivals in July every year, Firelight. Why am I having a mental blank on that? Because I just love fire. Firelight, the support for what other organisations like District Docklands do with the recent concerts on Saturday afternoons, for example, in January. Those sorts of initiatives, working with the AFL to encourage them to keep going with their development, to bring people down, all of those sorts of initiatives to bring fun and activity and enhance what happens in the area markets on Sundays, and the list goes on, indications and signals and real investments in this area, which we love. And as you know, as a former resident, and I appreciate so much of what a special place that is. It is a harbour, and we forget often across Greater Melbourne, Victoria, that we are a harbour city here in Melbourne, and it is a magnificent harbour and river. So, Sandra, thank you for your ongoing contribution and participation in these forums to make sure that these issues are top of mind for us. But can I assure you on behalf of all of us that these issues really are top of mind? And our next big step forward is coming back on the questions and issues raised at the forum last week, which I thought was fantastic, hard, but really worthwhile. And so that's why it was fantastic. And to be able to inform of the actions that are being taken at the moment to address those issues. So please hang in there with us, Sandra, and know that this is a daily conversation, at least multiple daily at Town Hall. And thanks again for staying till the end this evening. We appreciate it. I'm just going to check for those that have hung around for this long. Are there any other questions from the public this evening? Oh, please come and join us in this important discussion. Well, thank you so much all for jumping up tonight, or for staying as well, and saying that. We do appreciate it. And really, it's your leadership locally that called us to account and demanded that we listen. And we are better, all of us, as an organisation and as individuals, for the engagement we've had since then and the insights that you've brought us. But really, the leadership on local issues is so appreciated. It's coincided with reorganising ourselves around our neighbourhood program, and I think that's worked brilliantly. But the fact that you generously spent the time with us and walked us around the neighbourhood to show us, I think that also really made a difference. And then, of course, coming in, Deepa was here earlier, and I know she's doing great work too. But we want to say, and I can confidently say on behalf of all councillors and officers here, thank you for your leadership, because without that we wouldn't have changed the paradigm and the relationship of what's happening now. And there's still lots to do, but we're doing it in such a different way, far more effective, and we're seeing some great outcomes. So really, thank you very much. And outstanding, given that you were the most impacted out of COVID, that you still had the resilience and the persistence and determination to keep really nicely tapping us on the shoulder and so respectfully attending that last meeting in North Melbourne. And we got there in the end. So thank you very much. Well done, yeah. Good, any other comments or questions? No. Well, that means I can thank you all for participating in an action-packed meeting this evening. And I say thanks to our officers as well. Thank you, councillors. And we're closing the meeting at 9:29 p.m.